Verse 30. Merely by seeing things having the nature of illusion, there is no definiteness that one can eliminate afflictive emotions. For example, as a result of magical creations, when you create living things from a stone, piece of wood and so on, then you might get attracted to those creations. For example, you can get attracted to women that has been created through some magical performance. They are also, by seeing that, we might get attachment. Verse 31. So merely by seeing the disparity between appearance and reality, there's no guarantee to be able to remove afflictive emotions. Therefore, because there are so many levels of meaning to true existence or meaning to a false existence, because even according to Buddhist philosophies that accept selflessness, there are so many levels of different explanations. Selflessness could mean the lack of existence of person which is substantially existent or self-supporting, and through such an understanding of the view, it might to some extent hamper the growth of attachment and hatred, grosser levels of attachment and hatred. But still, the attachment and hatred that arises in relation to grasping of the self as truly existent still is possible. And if you go a little bit deeper and develop another higher level of view and philosophy, where you're able to see that not only the person but also the psychophysical aggregates of that person doesn't have inherent existence, and when you realize such a lack of inherent existence of the person and his or her psychophysical aggregates, I think this will help remove arisal of grosser level of thought. Now, for example, even from the mindfulness school of thought, if you are able to develop the view that there are no externally existent object and that they are just reflection and expression of the mind, that will also help reduce afflictive emotion to some extent. But still, you can develop attachment and hatred in relation to your internal mind. Now, on the other hand, if you are able to develop a view of the selflessness that sees that whether it is an external object or internal object, they do not have inherent existence, then you will be able to eradicate the conception of the self completely. And particularly when you proceed to the view of emptiness, as is explained from the point of view of Prasangika Madhyamika, where they say that there's not the slightest trace of inherently existent object from the sides of the object, then you won't find any object, any traces of object where you can develop attachment and hatred. So when the very focus of grasping is destroyed, then you don't have any object in relation to which you develop attachment and hatred. So I think this seems to be the case, but fine understanding of such views is possible only in terms of one's own experience and practice, and we cannot develop deep understanding just on explanation. And we can correctly assume that it is possible to develop such experiences in relation to understanding of such view of selflessness. And even if you have a minor experience, from that little experience you can presume that it is possible to develop an understanding or realization of emptiness or lack of inherent existence. And particularly if you reflect on the explanations of emptiness and selflessness as is found in the Madhyamika text, you will gain some conviction about such possibilities. And then this understanding have to be transformed into the level of experience. And therefore, unless you are able to develop such a deeper understanding, it is still possible to develop attachment and hatreds. And therefore, when it is not enough to for example, in the case of magical creation of horses and elephants, so on, from pieces of wood and stones, even though there you are able to see that things do not exist as it appears to us, but when they are actually created, you develop attachment and hatred. Therefore, until one has removed the imprints of afflictive emotions, when you encounter such a woman that has been created through magic, even by seeing that, you develop attachment. Verse 32 explains that when you get habituated with the wisdom, realizing emptiness, then you will be able to remove not only the afflictive emotions but also the imprints. And if you are able to develop strong realization and a strong feeling, and through such habituation with the imprints of emptiness, then you will be able to reduce and weaken the tight grasping. And if you have negated just the grosser level of object of negation, for example, is in the case of you may be able to remove grosser levels of grasping. But if you get habituated with the realization and understanding of subtle meaning of dependent origination, then it is not possible to develop subtle forms of self-grasping. And if you develop experience based on understanding of the subtle meaning of emptiness, and then in that case, it is not possible to develop grasping towards emptiness itself. On the other hand, if your understanding is a very grosser level of understanding of emptiness, then even after negating other objects as having no independent existence, but still you might feel that in the case of emptiness itself, it has true existence. So when we talk about emptiness, as I had explained earlier, emptiness cannot be explained without relating to a basis. And from one point of view, it is the basis, it is the foundation, which is more important in one way than emptiness, because it is those foundations, those bases, those objects with whom we relate in our day-to-day life, day-to-day experience. And even after achieving enlightenment, we have to relate to the objects. And therefore it is important to understand the nature of the object with whom we have to make repeated contact. And therefore the object or the basis of emptiness plays a very important role. And in the case of the object and basis, all these phenomena, they are devoid of inherent existence. At the level of perception of emptiness, the basis or object do not appear, and when such an object of investigation is not observed, and then that basis, which is the mere negation of the object of negation, is without any basis, it is free from basis, so therefore how can it abide before the mind? It can't exist before the mind. Verse 34. Therefore, whether it's a thing or non-thing, so long as they do not persist or exist before the mind, in other words, when you understand the emptiness of the pot, then even though there is no perception of pot, and likewise if you analyze the nature of the emptiness of the pot, then you will find the emptiness of the pot, and what you will find is the emptiness of the pot, of the emptiness of the pot, and there also you will not be able to perceive the object, the basis of that emptiness. So whether it is the object or the subjective mind, when you analyze, you do not find them. In our mind, until now, whatever appears to us, we tend to see them as having objective existence, but in reality there is no such objectively existent phenomena, and therefore it is important to confirm by using logic, reason, and also citing the scriptures that there is no such objectively existent phenomena, and therefore we need to confirm that. And it is in this way that you can remove all kinds of grosser levels of conceptual thoughts, starting from the grosser levels of grasping of the self. First you will be able to suppress their manifestation, and then gradually with repeated effort you will be able to remove the self-grasping, which is based on imagination and philosophical studies, and then gradually you will be able to remove the subtle innate self-grasping, and then finally even the seeds and the imprints of such self-graspings, and then finally you are able to fully understand or actualize the ultimate reality and nature of the very subtle mind. And it is in this way you actualize the resultant state of Buddhahood. And if you ask what is the state of such a state of Buddhahood, this is explained in verse 35. And the movement of all kinds of grosser level of conceptual thought cease at the state of Buddhahood, even though there is no discursive and grosser level of thought, but like wish fulfilling jewel and wish fulfilling celestial jewel, celestial tree, which fulfills the wishes of sentient beings without any motivation. And likewise, due to the fortune, merit and prayer of sentient beings, and because of the prayer, the power of the prayer and the accumulation of merit for countless eons by the Buddhas, after achieving enlightenment, Buddhas are able to appear themselves in a form that is relevant to the mind of the disciples. Verse 36. This is similar in the case of the Brahmin Sankhu. Who, after preparing a Garuda stupa or reliquary, and then he, after blessing that and preparing that, he passed away. And even after a long time after his passing away, still it maintained the power to purify poison and so forth. Or similarly, as is explained in verse 37, even though Buddha had passed, since a long time ago, but still one can still such a reliquary of the Buddha fulfill the wishes of sentient beings. Verse 38, if it is asked how could one have results by making offering to something that has no mind, but there is no definiteness, because whether the Buddha is living alive or has passed away, one can derive same merit by making offerings and showing respects to the stupas or the actual living Buddha. Verse 39 is saying that whether you accept them accept them in a conventional sense or in an ultimate sense, by making offerings to it, fruits will be obtained as is taught by the Buddha. For example, in your case, you accept Buddha having true existence, and by making offering to such a truly existent Buddha, you believe that fruits in the form of merits will be actualized. So similarly, in our case, when we make offering to a false Buddha, we also actualize false or superficial merits. And then the next verse explains that even in the case of those people who want to actualize liberation, it is important to realize emptiness. The first two lines of verse 40 is an argument by where some of the Vyabhishikas and Sautantikas, they say that merely by seeing the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, one will get liberated. So therefore, what need is there to see the meaning of emptiness? In other words, what need is there to see the leg of true existence of all phenomena. So therefore these philosophies are saying that it is not necessary to realize subtle emptiness to actualize liberation. But according to the ultimate thought of Nagarjuna, realization of emptiness is necessary not only for actualizing enlightenment but also for eliminating the afflictive emotions. And therefore these two lines of argument by the Vaibhashikas and so on are answered by saying that it is this wisdom realizing emptiness which is the path that liberates oneself from the cycle of existence. So the next two lines, the reason is that from the teachings of the Wisdom Perfection Sutra, it is said that in the absence of this path, realizing emptiness, it is not possible to actualize any of the three enlightenments, the enlightenment of the Sarvakas, the Pratyeka Buddhas, and the Bodhisattva. Then the need to realize emptiness is also established by using the reason. And for example, in the beginning of the Abhisamaya Alamkara, Maitreya says that I pay homage to the mother who is the mother of the Sarvakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, Bodhisattvas and the Buddhas. So not only the need to realize emptiness is taught in the sutras or from the scriptures, but this can also be established by using reason. First, a reason is used which can be accepted by both the parties. Because when you cite such a quotation, they might again argue by saying that the quotation you are citing is from Mahayana text, but we do not believe Mahayana as the teaching of the Buddha. So therefore, what are you trying to establish? This is what is explained in verse 41. Now this is counter-argued by the Madhyamikas by saying, then in this case, how could you also prove that the sutras that you accept, how could you believe as the authentic teaching of the Buddha? There are many Mahayana texts like this particular text, Bodhicharyavatara or Sutta Aramkara. They establish the Mahayana teachings of the Mahayanas as the teaching of the Buddha. So here the Mahayanas asked them by saying that then in your case, for example, with regard to the four sets of discourses, how could you believe that these are taught by the Buddha? And they answer by saying that because these Hinayana Sutras, these are accepted not only by us, but you also accept them, because both of us accept this as the teachings of the Buddha. And this is again counter-argued by the Mahayanas by saying that yes, it is true that right now we both accept this as the teaching of the Buddha, but my question is how, in the very beginning, how you were able to get convinced that these are the teachings of the Buddha? And so just as you used a reason to establish this as the actual teaching of the Buddha, so similarly we the Mahayanists also have the same reason. And if you are simply saying that this is true because it is accepted by two people or two parties, then this also is not correct reason. Because if you think about the Vedas, then you could say that these Vedas are also correct teachings, because it is possible that such teaching, Vedic teachings, are accepted by two parties. And verse 43 says that they might again argue by saying that the Mahayana teaching may be the teaching of the Buddha, but still it is really very controversial, therefore we are doubtful. And this is also a not correct reason, because in the case of some Hinayana teachings, like the teaching on the Four Noble Truths and so on, these are also controversial from the point of view of non-Buddhist practitioners, and they also argue with such teachings. And for example, there are certain Hinayana sutras which explains about the existence of intermediary state being, and these are also argued by some of the lower Buddhist philosophical schools, so therefore you can't accept them as the teaching of the Buddha. And therefore, if we do not accept the Mahayana teachings as the teachings of the Buddha, then it will be really difficult to establish the possibilities of achieving liberation. And also the actualization of enlightenment. And also when we think about the nature of Nirvana and enlightenment, we cannot distinguish them only in terms of how long period it takes to actualize them, but there should be some actual differences in terms of the causes that are responsible for actualizing them. So therefore, in the absence of a path, practice that encourages the development of bodhicitta, it is really difficult to actualize, not to talk about enlightenment, but also liberation. And also it's really difficult to say that a student who is more experienced and more learned than the Buddha, and at least from my point of view, I regard Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, Shantideva and so on as exceptionally talented people who would not accept anything like that without due analysis and examination. They would use logic, reason and relate it to their own experience, and it's in this way they accept Mahayana as the teaching of the Buddha, and based on that they have cited many quotations. For example, in this particular text, Bodhicharvatara, they cite a lot of quotations, but at the same time they will not accept these quotations unless they are able to find convincing proofs when they employ their own reason and experience. And this, and in the case of these great Indian masters, they were all Indians, and not much time has passed since the Buddha had passed away, and the process of study contemplation has been inherited or passed from one person to another person. Now, in the case of the presence of Manjushri and Maitreya, it may be slightly more difficult to establish their presence. But generally speaking, it is possible to present the existence of beings that are without physical body. So just as among the humanity, among the human beings, we find so many different types and categories, and similarly it is possible among other types of sentient beings. So in short, as I have always been saying, based on valid scripture, a valid commentary, valid lama, and one's own valid experience, we can confirm these things. And even if you do not have experience, if you ask such questions to other people, you will find that there are people who have special, amazing and interesting experiences. And particularly when you develop some kind of experience that will guide you and show you the path about the possibilities of developing higher and more amazing experiences, as has been taught and shared by many learned practitioners and scholars of the past. And also when we meditate and reflect on teachings on the development of bodhicitta, the usefulness of bodhicitta, and the development and the usefulness of wisdom, understanding, emptiness, we all find that apart from how much you are able to practice them, there is no doubt, no question about their usefulness. So I really do not think that these great masters were kind of narrow-minded, and the teachings that they give are based on narrow-mindedness and this will become very clear if you read their stories and read their books and scriptures. And also it seems that in the case of some of these great masters, because of their teaching and because of their practice and because of their power of prayer, they are able to benefit countless sentient beings. Even when we think in terms of these precious texts that are still present and that we are able to read, I think this also is much due to the power of their prayer. Otherwise it will be difficult to make such teachings and traditions continue for such a long time. So this could be understood based on our small little experiences. And in the teaching of the Buddha you will find two levels. There is three levels of teaching. One which is given to ordinary public, another level of teaching which is given to more selected followers, then another level of teaching which is given to very selected people, like the tantric teachings. And in the case of these secret tantric teachings also, there are many people who had practiced them and were able to develop genuine experience. So if you reflect in this way, it will help you gain more insight. Verse 44. And so these are continuous use of reasons to establish the need to realize emptiness in order to actualize liberation. And such verses can be explained in different ways. And what I am explaining here is based on the explanation of Minyakunsu Choji Thakwa. and the commentary that he has composed is really the most elaborate commentary, and he has cited countless quotations from many sutras and many commentaries and treatises. And Khunul Lama Rinpoche used to repeatedly praise this commentary. At that time, I did not have that text, but later on, I was able to obtain that text. This commentary, it was later on published in Tibet, and a number of copies then came to India. So verse 44 says that the root of the Dharma or teaching is the Bhikshu, and therefore, since Bodhicharya Avatara is a text which is read by all the four Buddhist schools of thought, and therefore Telugu Chenche Rinpoche, when he explained Bodhicharya Avatara to the Kagyu, he would use commentaries by Kagyupa masters, and then in the case of Gelugpa, there is commentary by Jessup J, and in the Nyingmapa tradition, I think there is a commentary of Bodhicharya Avatara by Lungchi Ramjampa, and it seems now it is not available. And so he used to give commentaries relevant to the students. So my commentary is based on Thupten Chodak, and Khunul Lama Rinpoche received the commentary on the wisdom chapter of Jessup J. from one Tashilumbo Kachin. So this verse 44 means that the root of the teaching of the Buddha, for the continuity and existence of the teaching of the Buddha, the root is the Bhikshu, in the sense of Arhat. And if you do not accept the realization of emptiness, then it will not be possible to destroy the focus of the mind, that means the afflictive emotions. And and if you are unable to realize emptiness, and if you are unable to destroy the afflictive emotions, which is the focus of the mind, then it is not possible, it will be very difficult to have bhikshus or arhats, because arhats refers to those that have destroyed all types of afflictive emotions, and such is not possible without realization of emptiness. It is very difficult to have arhats, because so long as your mind has the focus of the focus towards the afflictive emotions, and then without realizing emptiness, it is not possible to uproot the afflictive emotions. Now, in the case of afflictive emotions, there are one which is induced by the induced by different levels of grasping of the self. So, by meditating on the understanding of the 16 aspects of the four truths, one will be able to remove the afflictive emotions which are a result of grasping of the self, in the sense of seeing the self as substantially existent. But such a realization will not be able to remove the grasping of the self, where one sees the self as having true existence or inherent existence. So therefore, if you meditate only on the selflessness in the sense of seeing the self as having no substantial separate existence, then that will help you remove only grosser levels of afflictive emotions and not the subtle level of afflictive emotions. So therefore, it is not possible to transcend suffering, as is this is explained in verse 45. Because if you are able to actualize such a state of liberation only by meditating on the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, then this is tantamount to say that even only by removing the manifested levels of afflictive emotions, it is possible to achieve liberation. So verse 45 means that even without realizing the emptiness in the sense of having no inherent existence, and merely by getting habituated with the path that realizes directly the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, if you say that you can get liberated from suffering, then this is tantamount to say that only by removing the manifested levels of afflictive emotion, one can become an arahat and one can achieve liberation. But this is not correct, and you cannot accept this, because even in those cases of the people where they may have removed the manifested levels of afflictive emotions, but still you will see them being born into the samsara again. And now this is again argued by, as it said in verse 46, so in the case of this arhat, he is without craving, and and this is again answered by the Madhyamikas by saying that this craving, even though it is not the afflictive emotion, as is explained in the Abhidharma, or the afflictive emotion as you accept. However, just as in your case, in the case of ignorance and confusion, you make two divisions, one which is afflictive and one which is non-afflictive. So there is, so similarly in the case of craving also, even though it may not be afflictive, but it could still be a subtle grasping, similar in the case with the ignorance. Verse 47, the reason is that craving arises through the factor of feeling. So by meditating on grosser level of emptiness, even if you are able to suppress the manifestation of afflictive emotions, still in that person it has a feeling, and that feeling of true existence induces the craving. So here we are not talking about feeling in general, but here we are talking about a feeling that here we are talking about seeing the feeling as having true existence. And the next six lines means that whatever phenomena it is, so long as we see them as having objective existence and inherent existence, In other words, if the focus of two existences is there, so long as focus of two existences is there in the mind of some people, and then one will develop grasping of seeing the feeling as having two existences, and likewise craving and so on. And therefore, if you are devoid of a mind that realizes the subtle emptiness, then even for the time being, if you are able to remove grosser levels of afflictive emotions, but they will arise again when they encounter factors, just as in the case of an absorption without discrimination. Therefore, you must meditate on emptiness. Verse 49. Verse 49, 50 and 51. Some people say these three verses are not by Shantideva. Again, here an argument is made by saying that any speech or teaching which enters into sutra and vinaya and shows the precepts of the wisdom, then these can be accepted as the teaching of the Buddha. And therefore, since this so in order to actualize enlightenment, one side of the practice is compassion, another side is the wisdom understanding emptiness, as is explained in verse 52. In the case of the bodhisattvas who have achieved the path of the superior path, and when they realize emptiness, then they develop immense compassion towards those sentient beings who are confused, who suffer because of ignorance. Ignorance here refers to self-grasping, and it is due to self-grasping that they suffer. So it is for the sake of those suffering sentient beings who suffer out of ignorance. So for the sake of all these sentient beings who suffer because of ignorance, they aspire to achieve a state which is from the two extremes of attachment. Attachment here means that we are born within the samsara due to grasping and craving. And the other is the extreme of fear. That means the mere cessation of being born in the samsara. So therefore this refers to achievement of liberation just for oneself. So therefore this line explains the two extremes. The extremes of the extreme of being entrapped within the samsara, and the extreme of having achieved liberation just for oneself. So one is trying to achieve such a state which is free from these two extremes. That means to achieve omniscience and enlightenment. And therefore, verse 52 means that for the sake of those sentient beings who suffer, those countless sentient beings who suffer due to ignorance, and in order to achieve enlightenment, which is free from the two extremes of attachment and fear, and in order to actualize that, bodhisattva abides within the samsara out of compassion, and it is in this way one performs immeasurable activities for their benefit and manifest themselves into countless forms to be of benefit to these infinite sentient beings. So such is possible due to such is result of meditation on emptiness or realization of emptiness. Verse 53, 54, 55, and 56 shows therefore it is proper to meditate and aspire emptiness. And verse 53 reads that therefore to the side of emptiness it is unreasonable to try to refute, and therefore without doubt meditate on emptiness. And verse 54 reads that the antidote to the darkness of obscuration to liberation and obscuration to enlightenment is emptiness, and therefore those who aspire to achieve emptiness quickly meditate in this way on emptiness. And verse 55 reads and it is the grasping of things as having two existences which is really the producer of suffering. So therefore it is proper to develop fear to that, and whereas in the case of meditation on emptiness it is the only method and antidote to remove such true grasping and to alleviate such fears of grasping of things as having two existences. So therefore how could one develop fear towards such emptiness? This also means that if you are someone who aspires to remove afflictive emotions, then you should not develop fear towards emptiness, thinking that emptiness means nothingness. And when you equate emptiness to nothingness, this clearly is lack of proper understanding. And therefore, if you are someone who wants to destroy afflictive emotions, you must meditate on emptiness, and therefore you should be enthusiastic to develop such a view of emptiness. Verse 56, in the case of when we talk about emptiness, people develop fear because in our heart of heart we have strong grasping towards the self, thinking that there is a self which has independent existence and existence from their own side. However, realization of emptiness harms such a wrong notion and misconception of the self, misconception of the reality. But realization and understanding of emptiness does not harm the nominal and the conventional existence of the self. And therefore, if there is a self who has such a fear, has inherently existent nature, then you should develop fear towards the object. But since there is no person and self that has such inherently existent nature, therefore who should experience or develop such a fear? In the case of emptiness, we are talking about the ultimate nature of everything. So whether it is the person who meditates, who does the job, who does the work, who undertakes practice, the nature of the person is such that it doesn't have inherent existence. So therefore when we talk about lack of inherent existence of that person, we are only realizing the reality that is already there, and therefore why should one be fearful of it? Why should one be afraid of it? Because you are just understanding the reality. And instead of developing fear, you should think that until now I am unable to understand the reality of the self because I failed to understand the dependent origination. So therefore you should be happy. And then following verses make a detailed explanation about establishing the emptiness. So with regard to the elaborate explanation of the reasons establishing emptiness, first the reasons establishing the selflessness of the person is explained. And so here in the following three verses, 57, 58 and 59, these three verses establish negating the object of determination of inborn self-grasping, where it says that a person is not the teeth, not the hair, not the nails, and the self is not also the bones and the blood, not the mucus, not the phlegm, not the lymph, not the pus. And verse 58 reads, and the self is not also the fats, and the sweat, and likewise the lungs and the livers, and also not the entrails, also not other entrails. And verse 59 reads that the self is also not the excretion, the urine, the flesh, the skin, and the self is also not the heat, the wind, and not also the pores of the body, and the self is also none of the six consciousnesses. So this point needs a little bit thinking. Now among the Buddhist philosophical systems, there are some, there are many who try to pinpoint the self from within the six types of consciousness. And among the consciousness, there are different types of consciousness, past, present and future, in terms of time. And therefore when we talk about six consciousness, there are also minds with the parts, and even though they do not have directional parts, but they have parts in terms of their continuum and the stream. And when we try to find the basis of designation of these different types of consciousness, it's not possible to pinpoint or find them. And similarly, when we categorize the mind as gross and subtle, or conceptual or non-conceptual, and similarly mistaken and non-mistaken, and even on the level of the whether you try to pinpoint that person on the conceptual level, non-conceptual level, or mistaken level of the mind, or non-mistaken level of the mind, you won't find them. You won't find that self. That is the meaning of the six consciousnesses are not the self as well. Now with regard to the grasping of the self, as we have studied in the mind training like the rays of the sun, there is a grasping of the phenomena which grasps these psychophysical aggregates as having inherent existence, and then there is the grasping of the self and the person, and among the grasping of the person and the self there are again two, the grasping of the eye and the grasping of the mind. And then among the grasping of the self also, there is a grasping of self in terms of one's own self and also in terms of or relation to other people's self. And within the grasping of the self in relation to one's own self, there are again two types, grasping of I and the grasping of mine. So this kind of inborn grasping of the self is found among all sentient beings, including the tiniest insects. So this grasping of the self itself probably may not be wrong, but if you think what kind of grasping that you get when such grasping arises, you tend to see that I as objectively existent or existing from its own sight. If the I exists as it appears to your mind, then it should exist from its own side and so on. And however, if you are asked to find and pinpoint that I from within among your psychophysical aggregates and try to pinpoint that from the top of your head to the sole of your feet, you will not be able to find it. However, when you do not accept the self and the person as having inherent existence, but only nominally designated and conventionally existent, then in that case, there is no need to be able to find something when analyzed. So therefore, on the one hand, we have this innate self-grasping, and in order to further strengthen this innate grasping, we also use and employ certain reasons, and therefore, based on philosophical studies and through imaginations, we further strengthen that grasping. And that kind of grasping of the self is called imaginary grasping of the self, or grasping of the self due to philosophical studies or reasonings. And it is based on such wrong philosophical studies that we affirm the inborn innate grasping, and therefore we come up with a kind of solution saying that there is an I which can exist in isolation without having to depend on any of the five psychophysical aggregates. And even though the I may be existing among the five psychophysical aggregates, but the I is not dependent on it. So one may come up with such a philosophy, such a wrong conception, idea. So therefore, verse number 60 and 61 deals with the refutation of such imagined self. So I will just read the root text, and I myself do not know the details of all this, and it will also take a long time to explain them. So basically, these were two verses, verse 60 and 61, is a refutation of the self as is presented by the Sankhyas. This is the viewpoint of the Sankhya is refuted by saying that if there is this self which is permanent, then in that case then either the sound which is perceived by such a self should be permanent, or the person which perceives the sound should be impermanent. So there is this kind of complication. And next is refutation of the answer, which is explained in verse 62, 63, 64, 65, 66 and 67. The Samkhyas accept a self which is permanent, solitary, and this has been refuted by these verses. And next is refuting the possession of the Vaisheshikas. This is explained in verse 68 and 69. Next is refuting the argument. Having refuted such a self, and this is refuted by saying that if there is no self, then we cannot make a connection with the action and their result. This is explained in verse 70. If there is no self, then we cannot make a relation between the cause and the result. And if it is only this physical and psychophysical aggregate and there is no self in relation to this, then we cannot talk about the relation between the cause and the effect. And that's why we do see some people who has some idea about Buddhism, they ask the question by saying that the Buddhists do not accept a self, and in that case, who is that self that goes to next life and so on. They come with this kind of questions and misconceptions. So the same thing is kind of asked here. So if there is no self apart from the psychophysical aggregate, then it is improper to maintain relationship between the action and the result. And similarly, after having performed an action, when the action disintegrates, then whose action is this? So unless we think about continuous existence of the continuity of the self, it will be very difficult to maintain such effect and action result relationship. And in that case, the person who was at the time of accumulating the action, and then later on the person who experiences such result, these two are totally different. And then this would amount to say that one person performs the action and another experiences the result. And therefore, having performed the action, since the action disintegrates, then later on you have a different mind, different body, and there is no self, then whose action is this? Verse 71, 72, 73 and 74 answers these questions. The person who was there at the time of the accumulation of the cause and who experiences the result and the fruit, and while you are performing an action at that time, the psychophysical aggregates that is there at that time, and while experiencing the fruit, that at that time also there is a psychophysical aggregate. These two are different. And during these two occasions, the actions performed by such a self, and at that time such a person is not the accumulator of the action and also experience of the result, and this is what you who accept the self as permanent also accepts, and this is something that I also accept, who doesn't accept the self as having two existence. So therefore this is not a subject of argument. But there is a merely designated psychophysical aggregate, and in the case of the person, there is, even though no truly existent or permanently existent self, but there is a merely designated self, and similar is the case in the case of any of the psychophysical aggregates. If you analyze and examine them, you won't find, but when not analyzed, when not searched, there is a nominally existent psychophysical aggregate, and likewise there is a self in the person that is designated on such continuity of psychophysical aggregate, and therefore in relation to this same continuity we use the term that he is the experiencer or performer of the action and so on. And it is because of the same continuity we make such statements saying that such and such and such person has accumulated the action and has experienced the result and so on. Even though earlier we had explained that the six consciousnesses are not the self, but once again, as is explained in verse 73, that in the case of the mind also, the mind that is past and the mind that is yet to come, these are not the self. And even in the case of the present mind, that could also be further examined by splitting it into the mind this morning, the mind of evening and so on, and then in this case you won't find such a mind. So there is, it cannot be the self. So even in the case of the mind that's already produced, even this mind that has been produced and not ceased, that means even in the case of the present mind that is not the self, because the mind changes and disappears, the self continues tomorrow and so on. And in that state of disintegration of the mind also, self is not found, because if that mind is self, then this is tantamount to say that when the mind disintegrates, then the self also disintegrates. Verse 74. So whether you look in terms of the collection, the aggregate, or in terms of the parts, you won't find anything from such basis. So in this way, when you analyze the self, you won't find any object where you can pinpoint your finger. But at the same time, if you say that there's no self, this contradicts your experience. And if you say that the self is existent, then you are unable to pinpoint it. So this leads to the conclusion that it is only imputed and designated. So this is really like examining a plantain tree. If you split it into different parts and analyze, you won't find it. and therefore we can conclude that the I doesn't have inherent existence or objective existence. And if there is no self having inherent existence, then there cannot be a mind having inherent existence. Then verse 75, 76 and 77 refutes the argument that in that case it is improper or unnecessary to meditate on compassion, because if there is no samsara, if there is no self, there cannot be samsara. If there is no samsara, there cannot be liberation. And if there is no sentient being, there cannot be Buddha. And so verse 75 reads that if the sentient beings are non-existent, to whom you develop compassion? Buddhas, sentient beings, samsara, nirvana, this should must exist. And when your mind is afflicted, you are within the samsara. When your mind is without afflictive emotions, you are liberated. And so those that have removed both obscurations is called an enlightened being, and those who have not removed it, they are sentient beings. So if there is no such self, then there will be no sentient being, then you can't develop compassion, as is so much encouraged in this text. This is answered by saying that even the cause may be very superficial and false, but one can experience result. For example, if you tell a number of lies and big lies, then the lies which are the causes, these lies themselves are false and superficial, but it can produce immense sufferings. So therefore it is true to say that sentient beings do not have true existence. However, on the conventional, nominal sense, we can meditate on compassion towards sentient beings. So it is for the sake of eliminating the sufferings of the mind, it is for that, for the purpose of those results, we make the effort to achieve enlightenment. And therefore all these qualities and phenomena that we accept for the purpose of result, they are all existent. But if you ask whether these phenomena are presented by investigating the basis of designation or without searching the basis of designation. So this is answered by saying that these are all designated by ignorance. That means that whichever we have accepted for the sake of the fruit, these are presented without searching the basis of designation. So here ignorance has a different meaning. So the word ignorance means that everything that we had accepted for the sake of the fruit, like enlightenment, they are accepted through ignorance, meaning that they are accepted from the parlance of what is known to the worldly people without searching the basis of designation. So without presenting something on the basis of designation, on the basis of imputation, you won't find anything existing from their own site. So from the parlance of the Madhyamika viewpoint, things are accepted without analyzing, without investigating, and it is on the basis of such an understanding we can experience, we can talk about suffering, experiencing suffering and so on. And even though there is no sentient being who can be found out by searching the basis of designation, but without searching, sentient beings exist, and there is no disagreement about that. For example, you can all see me sitting on the throne, and that you can all see me that I am talking, and there is no need to search who is there, what is his nature, and so on. So that is the reality. So this is really like so when you explore in this area, it's really very amazing. Normally we take everything for granted, that things existing from their own site independently and so on, but there is no such existence, and so that is our reality. And verse 76 reads that if sentient beings are not, sentient beings do not truly exist, and what is the result? And this is true. And as Milarepa has said, from the perspective of true existence, and then there is no true cessation, there is no samsara, there is no sentient being, there is no omniscience, there is no enlightenment. So it is true to say that things do not, sentient beings do not have true existence, but from what is known to the world, they all exist. And in order to get rid of sufferings, and in order to get liberated from the samsara, in order to achieve liberation, and particularly the non-abiding nirvana, since all these conventionally exist, therefore in order to get rid of sufferings, you should not refute the fruit, that these fruits are merely designated without analyzing and without searching them, or without searching the basis of designation. And particularly in the case of those of us, the ordinary beings who have not realized emptiness, the appearance of true existence is always there. Verse 77. And it is because of this ignorance towards the self, that means the self-grasping, which is the real source of suffering. And it is because of this ignorance that grasping to oneself, which is the cause of suffering, arises. And if you say that since this is more difficult than the first one, therefore we cannot stop it, this is answered by saying that meditation on selflessness is supreme. Meditation on selflessness is supreme, because this can be established through valid reasoning and valid perception. We can prove that there is no self having inherent existence, whereas in the case of existence of the self, a self that is independent, inherently existent, such a self cannot be proved with logic and with reason. So here when we talk about self, it's important not to get confused. The word self sometimes could refer to the conventional nominal or the mere self, and the self also refers to the object of negation, as is highlighted in the 400 verses by Arya Deva. So self refers to something that has independent or inherent existence. So such kind of self is not there in relation to any phenomena, and because this grasping of the self is a misconception of the reality and has no solid foundation, so it cannot be maintained. And next is meditation on selflessness of the phenomena, and this will be explained by meditation on the four mindfulness. The first is explaining the first, the selflessness of the phenomena is explained in terms of meditation on four mindful, maintaining the four mindfulness. And out of which the first explanation refers to meditation on maintaining mindfulness in relation to one's body. And this also will be explained under four subtitles. The first subtitle, or in other words, verse 78, 79, 80, 81, 82, and 83, and 84. These seven verses establishes the lack of inherent existence of the body, which is the whole. So the maintaining or meditation on four mindfulness can be done in relation to one's body and so on, and similarly in relation to our other's body and so on. This meditation on four mindfulness practices are done in relation to body, feeling, mind, and dharma. Now here when we talk about body, as soon as we talk about body, we tend to see or imagine it as something solid. And then when we talk about hand, legs, and so on, we see it as the parts of the body. So by seeing one of these parts of the body, we feel that we have seen the whole body. So whether it's the whole or the part, when you search, you won't find it. So as I explained earlier, the next seven verses explain about how the body, which is the whole, doesn't have inherent existence. The body is not the leg, not the calves, not the thigh, not the waist, and not the belly, not the back, and not the breast, not the shoulders. And similarly, verse 79, the body is not the ribs, not the hands, not the armpits, not the shoulders or arms, not the entrails, not the head, throat, and where will you find the body? Verse 80. And you should also analyze whether this body is found towards all the parts of the body. And as is explained at verse 81, if it abides on each and every part of the body like the hand, then you have to say that a whole of body is found in each of these parts, and likewise the body is not found externally or internally, and therefore how can you say that the body exists on the hand, and apart from the hand and so on, how can you prove the existence of the body? And verse 83 reads, therefore in those parts of the body like hand and so on, where the body is non-existent, but out of ignorance we perceive them as a body that is having true existence or independent existence. So this is really like seeing a pile of stone as a human being because of the shape of those pile of body. And so long as all these necessary factors come together, a person, this body appears as a person. And likewise, until such a body exists on the hand and so on, there you perceive the body as having true existence. So this clearly shows that things are just designated, and apart from that you won't find or discover something. And same is the true in the case of the parts of the body like hands and so on. And so therefore verse 85 and 86 establishes the lack of inherent existence of the parts. And similarly in the case of the hand, it is a gathering of even in the case of your hand, it is collection of different fingers and joints. And and even these fingers, in the case of the hand, it is a collection of fingers, and even in the case of fingers, it is a collection of the joints of the fingers. And if you again split the joints into different parts, into different particles and particles, then that particle also has directional parts, and those directional parts again if you split, then like the space you won't find any particles. So in the end you will not be able to present a body. And next two lines. Since in this way things do not have inherent existence, then why should we develop attachment to something that is like a dream? And therefore to this dream-like body and person, how should an intelligent person develop attachment? And the next two lines establishes the lack of inherent existence of the person, just as because body doesn't exist inherently, therefore how can you posit man and women or male and female? And the next is meditation on the mindfulness of the feeling, and which will be explained under 4 points. The first point explains the lack of inherent existence of feeling, and this will be explained under 3 subtitles. The first title explains about the lack of inherent existence of feeling of suffering. So the first 2 lines of verse 88 explains that if the feeling of suffering has true existence, then it cannot be changed. And if it cannot be changed, then this would directly harm and contradict the possibilities of experiencing joy. It will not be possible to develop joy. So if suffering exists in the nature of suchness, means if suffering exists inherently or truly, then how would this not harm joy? That means this will definitely harm experiencing joy, and it will not be possible to experience joy, because if suffering of feeling exists truly, then that you cannot change. And then the next 2 lines of verse 88 explains the lack of inherent existence of feeling of joy. And even in the case of feeling of happiness and joy, if it has again has true existence, because if the experience of happiness and peace has true existence, then it should not be disturbed by feeling of pain, suffering, or enjoying delicious food and so on. Verse 89 reads, even though here it is argued by saying that even though the suffering truly exists, but because at that time one has a very powerful experience of happiness and peace, and overpowered by such an overwhelming experience of peace and happiness, one is not experiencing suffering at that time, then this is answered by saying that that which is not experienced, how could that be seen as a feeling? That cannot be a genuine feeling. And this is again argued by saying that this experiencing of the subtle suffering, even though it is feeling, but but it is eliminated by this overwhelming experience of happiness. Then this is answered by saying that in that case, even this experience of the subtle feeling has to be accepted as not suffering, because you are categorizing it in the category of experience of happiness and peace. if feeling has true existence, the feeling, the notion that feelings are truly existent is merely designated, and in reality there is no such truly existent feelings. And then in verse 92, we are instructed to meditate on the leg of inherent existence of feeling. It is because of the fact that the feeling doesn't have true existence. And therefore, as an antidote to this grasping of seeing the feeling as having true existence, we should meditate on leg of inherent existence of all phenomena, or the wisdom that analyzes the leg of inherent existence of all phenomena. It is through such investigation one will actualize higher concentrations as a result, and it is through this way that one can promote one's realization, and therefore it is like a food for that yogi who engages in higher levels of concentration. So here it is really not enough simply to think that things are devoid of inherent existence, but one should analyze, and through analysis investigation one should develop conviction about lack of inherent existence of all phenomena. And without analyzing, simply maintaining one-pointed meditation towards lack of inherent existence will not be enough to further strengthen the realization of emptiness. And next is refuting the inherent existence of the cause. This will be explained under three divisions. The first division explains about lack of inherent existence of encounter or contact of the object and the sense faculties. This is explained under next three verses, 93, 94, 95. The meeting of sense power, object and sense consciousnesses are done without analyzing and without investigating, and based on that feelings can be produced. But if you search the basis of designation, then as is explained in verse 93, that if in between the object and the sense power, if there is a gap between them, and then how could they meet? So this is really searching the basis of designation. And if there is a gap between them, how could they meet? Just like the mountain on the east and the west. And if there is no gap at all, then if there is no gap at all, then they are one. Now this is not true in the ordinary sense, but this is true if you accept those things as having true existence. And if they are one, then how could you explain which one is contacting which? And similarly, the subtle particles of the object and the sense powers, they also do not meet. And because if this one particle goes into other particle, and then they would dissolve into one another, because all these subtle particles have no hollow inside, and their size is also same. And when they do not mix, they cannot enter into each other, and when they do not mix, then they never meet each other from all directions. Next verse 96 is refuting the inherent existence of meeting or contacting with the consciousness. In the case of consciousness, it is non-physical, and therefore there is no meeting having inherent existence. And then next verse 97-98 refutes the inherent existence of contact which arises through the meeting of the three, the sense power, the object and the sense consciousness. And if there is no contact, from where feeling arises, and therefore why you should tire yourself for the feeling of happiness. And when the person and the self, who is the feeler, doesn't have inherent existence, and similarly the feeling also doesn't have inherent existence, and by seeing that, how couldn't one destroy the samsara or cycle of existence, which is a state free from experiencing pleasurable feeling and feeling of suffering. And next first two lines of verse 99 explains the lack of inherent existence of the object of the focus, whether it is seen by the eye or touched by the physical body. The objects of feeling are devoid of inherent existence, like a dream, like an illusion. And the next two lines of verse 99 explains the lack of inherent existence of the object of the feeling. Because the mind that arose at the same time with the feeling is not seen by the feeling, because it is produced at the same time. Verse 100, and those minds that are generated before the feeling or subsequent to the feeling, and those that are generated before the feeling cannot have feeling, because feeling is here to come. These are also not experience. By oneself and by others, and therefore feeling doesn't have inherent existence. So therefore, to this collection of psychophysical aggregate which doesn't have inherent existence, what's the benefit brought about by peaceful feeling, and how could it be harmed by the feeling of suffering? Next is meditation on the mindfulness of mind. So the next two verses, verse 102 and 103, explains the lack of inherent existence of mental consciousness. In the case of mental consciousness, it does not abide in the sense powers like the eye sense power, and also do not abide in the object like the physical form, and does not abide in between them, and therefore they are not observed. And the inherently existent mind is not found within the body or outside the body and not elsewhere, therefore the mind is not found, and it's also not found in the body or somewhere else, and also to get mixed with the body, and therefore there is not the slightest trace of inherent existence of mental consciousness. And next, six lines, verse 104 and the first two lines of verse 105 explains the lack of inherent existence of the five consciousnesses. And if these consciousnesses are there before the object, then what is the focus of, what is their object of focus? And if they are of the same time, and then with regard to which object the mind is produced, and if the consciousness comes subsequent to the object, and then again from reference to which object the consciousness can be produced. Next two lines of verse 105 explains the meditation on the mindfulness of the dharma or quality. And as has been explained, that with regard to all phenomena, it is not possible to realize all phenomena as having true existence, because in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end, we did not see the slightest trace of any phenomena having true existence. And next is refuting the argument which says that if you do not accept things having true existence, then it is not possible to posit the two truths. Verse 106 reads that in case if all phenomena do not have inherent existence, then in that case there will be no conventional phenomena that experiences production and disintegration, and in that case how could the Madhyamika system present the true truths? And also, if the conventional truth is presented from the perspective of a mistaken level of the mind or conventional mind, and then in that case how could the sentient beings transcend suffering or achieve liberation also on a conventional level, and therefore it is not possible for them to actualize liberation? This is answered in the next two verses, verse 107 and 108. But this is the conceptual thought of the mind of others. That means that this conceptual thought of true grasping is other than what has transcended suffering. meaning that this is a mistaken conventional nature of the mind. Later on, when you transcend suffering, when you actualize liberation, and then when you realize that this is a mistaken conception, and even that time there will be the conventional truth, there will be conventional reality. Because if such a concept, mistaken conceptual thought, is non-existent, then this amounts to say that the conventional truth also cannot exist. And therefore, the designating conceptual thought and the and those that has been designated by such conceptual thoughts, these are mutually dependent. And therefore, if the object doesn't exist, the mind also cannot exist. And therefore, you cannot analyze in this way. If such an argument is presented, this is answered by saying that it is not necessary to have a truly existent conceptual thought, which is the designating mind, because in the case of the object, it doesn't have a true existence. And because the object doesn't have true existence, and therefore the mind giving the designation also doesn't have true existence. But this does not mean to say that you cannot analyze, you cannot judge, because S is known to the worldly conventions, and merely based on terms, names and designations, it is possible to analyze everything. Because when you analyze based on the commonly known perception, then it cannot be harmed, in the sense when you posit something, it should be something that is known to the worldly mind, conventional worldly mind, and it should not be harmed by other worldly conventional mind. Now, for example, in the case when we say there is horn on the head of the rabbit, and if we say there is horn on the head of the rabbit, this is known to worldly conventional mind, but at the same time it is harmed by other worldly conventional mind. So therefore you cannot accept the horn of rabbit as having existence. So according to, even according to the Prasangika Madhyamika system, there is a level of phenomena which is known to the worldly mind and which exists, and there is another category which is known to the worldly mind but doesn't exist. So therefore it is really important to be able to make a clear distinction between how different between a nominal or conventionally existent object and conventionally non-existent object. Unless you are able to make a clear presentation of it, then you would either come to the conclusion that nothing exists, or you would come to the conclusion that everything has true independent existence. It is explained in verse 108. According to the Prasangika Madhyamika viewpoint, as is explained by Chandakirti, whether you talk about the whole and the part, and the perceiver and what is perceived, they are all relative. Similar like the presentation with regard to long and short. Long is long in relation to short, and short is short in relation to something that's longer to it. So it is in relation to what is well known to the worldly conventions, that things are presented. Verse 109 and 110 refutes the argument that this will become infinite or endless. Now the opponent argues by saying that if you need to analyze phenomena as having true existence or no existence, or having or empty of inherent existence or not, and in that case the mind that analyzes the object in this way should also be analyzed by another mind, seeing whether it has inherent existence or not, and in that case it will become endless. This is answered by answered in verse 110 by saying that when you analyze the object and see it as having inherent existence or not, and through that way when you are able to affirm that it doesn't have inherent existence, then even if you do not analyze the mind that is doing such analysis, you will be able to understand the lack of inherent existence of that mind.